Is it true? Is it necessary? And is it kind? Those are the requirements for saying something. First, is it true? Is what you're about to say true? And is it necessary? And is it kind? And sometimes necessary trumps kind. But those are the qualifying factors for opening my mouth. Now, that doesn't mean I always do that. I heard the way you talk to your kids becomes their inner voice. And that really shook me because I think that might be true.
Reboots episode R047 features a very talented guy. Tony is a recovering alcoholic, and he is an artist who illustrates the 12 steps of recovery at 12stepsillustrated.com. That's 12stepsillustrated.com. You are not going to hurt my feelings if you just hit pause on this podcast and go over on your phone or your computer, wherever you are, and type in 12stepsillustrated.com. Join Tony's email list. Just do it now. Whether you're in recovery or not, you are going to really enjoy his drawings. Here's Tony's story. When he decided his family was more important than alcohol, Tony walked into his first AA meeting. And that's when he picked up his childhood passion again and started drawing the 12 steps just as a means for reducing each step to its most basic premise. Tony, let's have an attaboy here. Tony is in his ninth year of sobriety. Yeah, that's awesome. And he abides by the Alcoholics Anonymous tradition of using first names only. We honor that tradition for this episode.
Hey there, you're dialed into Reboots, featuring stories about people who have been forced to start over in life or in business, all walks of life, anonymous or named, high profile or low down, stories with heart, soul, and grit. Because knowing and sharing our stories is essential for living a life of joy, experiencing healthy relationships, and impacting the world around us in a positive way. Here's your host, Tracy Winchell.
Hey, Tony, thanks for inviting us into your life again today.
Yeah, thank you for having me again.
Yeah, just to be absolutely clear, this is the second time we've done this interview. The first time I messed up the audio settings, and you've been kind enough to say, yes, I want to do this again because I loved your story and I want to get it right. You are the creator of 12 Steps Illustrated. Tell me about 12 Steps Illustrated and how somebody can make sure that they get your work in their inbox every month.
Sure. So 12 Steps Illustrated really started early on in my recovery. What it's kind of become is a visual aid to the 12 steps of AA. And the goal is to give folks that are still suffering from addiction a bit of hope by sharing some love, laughter, and sometimes cold, hard truth. We don't get sober to be miserable. And it's hard to be miserable when you're laughing. So that's kind of the idea behind 12 Steps Illustrated. You can see more at 12stepsillustrated.com. We're also on Facebook, 12 Steps Illustrated, and on Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest. So,
yeah, we'll make sure we get the links to all of those locations and share that. Well, tell me how you got involved with illustrating the 12 steps.
Sure. So my story, I guess, I've always been an artist. When I was younger, I would drew a lot, became an artist professionally, did some illustrations for toy companies, worked in video games. But I quit sort of illustrating for myself, for my own pleasure, the more that I drank. So once I got into recovery, I started to pick up pencil and paper again, talking to folks in recovery at a meeting, and they were discussing how a lot of people tend to overcomplicate the steps. And being an artist, in my mind, the simplest form of communication is an image. So I thought, why don't I try to illustrate each of these steps into a single image? That's really how this all started. I started illustrating step one based on what I knew at the time and the readings, talking to my sponsor, talking to other people in recovery. Came up with the illustration, showed it to my sponsor, and he was impressed. He's like, this is really good. And so I continued. I illustrated all of the steps after that relatively quickly and started to think about sharing them and how I could share them. I originally put them all into a calendar. 12 steps, there's 12 months, just kind of fit. So put them in a calendar, had some printed and started showing people, and they wanted to buy them. So that was back in 2011. And I've been doing the calendars. I did the calendars for probably like 3 or 4 years, and then I ran out of money. So I stopped. This year, I had a buddy sort of help me out, and I was able to get the calendars printed again. And I also started a monthly comic series. So each month, it's a small comic that goes out. It's based on each of the 12 steps, funny stories, memes, things like that, to help people focus on the step of the month.
Well, I love getting the illustrations in my inbox, and there are moments when my computer is defiled because I'm spewing something all over it, like because I'm laughing so hard. And then there are illustrations that just make me go, what's Tony trying to say here? So I want to ask you about a few of those as we move forward. But I also want to get something kind of out of the way up front. You respect the 12-step tradition to just go by your first name. And I think that's awesome. And that's why we're just going to refer to you as Tony from 12 Steps Illustrated. Talk to me about that decision when you decided you wanted to take your work public and sort of practice your recovery in public and help others practice in public. I talk to podcasters a lot who are in 12-step programs, and they wrestle with that decision to use their last name or first name only. Talk me through that, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. When I first came into the program, and thought about, you know, coming into AA, it wasn't the happiest time. So thinking about going into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's not a lot of pride in that, you know, coming in.
Right.
So there's a lot of guilt, a lot of shame. And so for me coming in, I was afraid people were going to know that I had a problem. And the funny thing, my sponsor at the time told me, he goes, I go, you know, I'm afraid these people are going to know that I have a problem. He goes, Tony, they already know. You're the only one who doesn't think you have a problem. So the humor side of it started pretty early for me, you know, when I first came in. But as far as the anonymity part, it was really allowed me to be Tony.
Right.
Just to be myself. I didn't have to put on, you know, a show for anybody to keep that facade of that I'm better than, or that I'm this or that I'm that. And it didn't matter what my checkbook was, what car I drove, what clothes I wore, what shoes I had, none of that mattered. And so I was able just to be Tony. I'm broken. I'm sad. I'm up from down. I'm scared. And to be able to just say that without any of the rest of life's baggage and, you know, and putting on that the machismo and, you know, I've got to be strong and tough and, you know, don't be a sissy and that whole mentality. And I was able just to get past all that.
Yeah. Tony, that was my experience too. You know, I live in a town where my face and my name and my voice are pretty high profile. And yeah, I just didn't want to walk into a meeting the first time. And a group of 70 or 80 people gave me the gift of anonymity until I told them, hey, I'm that girl you used to watch on TV or listen to on the radio. And what a gift it was. And Tony, I didn't even know I needed that gift. I had no idea my identity was so wrapped up into what other people thought I should be. So I'm with you. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So I want to backpedal just a little bit where you talked about your brand new sponsor. You're new in the program. And he says, you're the only one who thinks you're successfully hiding your program. And one of my favorite illustrations of yours, and I want to put a link in the show notes here, it's this green dude with gnarly teeth. And it says, being an alcoholic is like having bad breath. Everyone close to you knows, but no one says anything. But tell me about, how early were you into your recovery when you created that illustration? It's ugly.
That one actually came to me relatively recently. Some of the stuff I have is older, and a lot of it's new. I'm coming up with a lot of new content. And I don't know where some of these thoughts come from. A guy in the program is like, you know, you got to get better at not verbalizing your first thought.
Oh, that's deep.
Yeah. I don't know where it comes from, honestly. I think it was early in the morning and I was brushing my teeth and the thought just kind of like, yeah, being an alcoholic is a lot like, you know, having bad breath and standing next to somebody and in a group or a crowd, and they don't really want to say anything, but they all know.
Yeah.
It's that same idea. People have a hard time understanding these concepts until they're verbalized in another way or through an image.
Right. Let's walk through that. Why is it? I mean, we live in a society where we think we're supposed to say exactly what's on our mind as soon as it's on our mind. We have this incredible capacity to say whatever's on our mind to thousands of people on social media. Why is that a bad idea in your mind?
Well, I think a lot of people are more willing to verbalize their thoughts on social media because of the anonymity of it. If I share something on social media, I'm removed from it. It's kind of like driving. If I'm driving and I speed, I see them merging ahead in my car, it's okay for me to go zipping by them and merge in ahead of everybody. Right? Everybody that sees me do it is not happy with me, but you wouldn't do that at a grocery store.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't do that in a line in McDonald's. If you see the line, you don't zip up to the front of it and try to merge in.
Right. My Aunt Jo said once, and I attribute it to her as a saying, but she said it once and it was brilliant and I've never forgotten it. You didn't have to say it just because it's so. And oh my gosh, there is so much truth in that. And that's why I journal, because I want to separate my thoughts from my feelings. That's really important. But I don't really need to do that in public. And I usually don't need to do that in front of people I love, because once I say it, I can't take it back. And once I write down what I'm thinking, how I'm feeling, in a private situation, then I can decide, does this need to be verbalized? And if so, how do I make sure I'm being respectful of the people I love? Is that kind of what you're saying there?
Yeah. So early in the program too, this guy, Nick, he's passed on. He used to say, is it true? Is it necessary? And is it kind? He said, those are the requirements for saying something. First, is it true? Is what you're about to say true? And is it necessary? And is it kind? And sometimes necessary trumps kind. Mm-hmm. But those are the qualifying factors for opening my mouth. Now, that doesn't mean I always do that, especially,
right,
you know, with the people that are closest to me. They've seen me at my worst. You know, and sometimes it's the the broken shoelace that puts me over the top. You know, it's not necessarily the big stuff.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, and in the program too, we reference a lot, restraint of tongue and pen. I can't unsay something like you were saying there. I can't take those words back. You know, and as kids, we grow up and say, you know, sticks and stones and break my bones and your words will never hurt me. But that's not really true.
Yeah, that's a lie.
You say that so that you feel better as a kid, like even though we know those words do hurt. And a lot of times I've heard so many great things in recovery and really learned how to be a sober adult.
Mm.
And one of the things that I think about quite a bit with my own life and my kids is I heard the way you talk to your kids becomes their inner voice.
Oh, wow.
And that really shook me because I think that might be true. You know, we tend to be really hard on ourselves and we beat ourselves up and I'm not good enough. I'm not this, you know, and if somebody told me when I was a kid that I was dumb, if I believed it, then every time I get into a situation, I can't do that. I'm dumb. That negative self-talk that I believe those things. And there was a great book that I read too in recovery, The Four Agreements, and it talks about that.
I want to read that book. I have not read it.
It's helped me quite a bit. And it just talks about how we are domesticated as we grow up through childhood. Don't do this, don't do that. And the things, those negative things that we hear growing up become our agreements.
Mm.
You know, somebody had told me, Tony, you're not very good at art. You really shouldn't draw anymore. And if I would have believed that, that would have been one of my agreements. I probably wouldn't be drawing now.
Wow. You know, when I remember the first time we had this conversation, you talked about how important drawing was to your recovery. And actually, you, if I remember properly, your story of origin was such that, and you alluded to this a minute ago, that alcohol replaced your love for drawing. So can we just kind of move into that and why and how you started drinking, and then just kind of walk through your recovery story, if you don't mind. And then I want to come back to the importance of creativity in your recovery.
When I drank, I didn't care. Mm. I was 6'4" and 280 pounds. I was, you know, I was more confident. I was better looking. I was able to talk to the girls. I didn't, you know, all of that. It worked and it was fun. You know, I made friends. I had a good childhood. You know, I was loved by my parents, but all of those insecurities of even of just being a kid.
Yeah.
It's tough being in junior high back in the 80s.
Oh, man. Yeah.
You know, it was a totally different time.
Oh.
You know, there was fights in the schoolyard and, you know, all that stuff. When I hung out with my friends, started drinking, it didn't matter.
Mm.
All of that, that angst and that fear, that all went away. And, you know, it was a lot of fun back in the day. But I think early on, I drank alcoholically from the start. I remember the first time I went out drinking with my buddies. We were on our bikes. And we got into one of my buddies, I think it was his stepmom's apartment. And there was a liquor closet of some sort, random bottles of booze. And so we started swigging off different bottles. And
oh, wow.
I loved it. Hmm. I felt amazing. But I also couldn't stop.
Hmm.
So I continued and then I drank more and I drank more. And then I was throwing up all over my bike.
How bad.
So, you know, early on when I drank, I couldn't stop. I knew in my mind, being from an alcoholic home, I knew what that was like. And I knew I didn't want to be like my dad. But back of my mind, I kind of knew that I might be an alcoholic already.
And how old were you when you kind of started processing all of this?
It was 14, 13.
Wow, Tony. And then this is when you kind of stopped drawing, right?
Well, no, I still continued. Back then I was about 13. Yeah, that was the first time I drank, but that was when I started drinking more, as often as I could, kind of, you know, I would drink on weekends and parties and, I graduated from high school, went to college, but once I graduated from high school, my drinking really kind of escalated. Mm. I didn't have to go to school every morning. So, I surrounded myself with the people that did what I do so that I was more comfortable doing what I wanted to do. So all the people that I hung out with drank. And if they didn't, I didn't really want to be around those people. So the guys that I drank with could drink. And if they couldn't, I found people that could, because it was normal then. It wasn't a problem if everybody else was doing it. And I think in hindsight, I didn't really realize that's what I was doing, but I see that now. I didn't hang out with people that didn't drink. And that goes back to from when I was younger, all of the people, the males, the role models that I had as a kid, all drank. That's what men do. Go to work, provide, come home, and they drink. They get together with their friends and their families, and they get drunk. So that, to me, was normal.
Right. And you found the love of your life. You get married. You have kids, and you're still hiding this bad breath kind of thing you got going on, right?
Well, yeah. So my drinking escalated. I continued to drink. I drank, on weekends. And every once in a while, I'd fall off the rails and get really drunk, and then everybody'd be like, wow, you overdid it. And it's like, I got to slow down. I don't want to be like that. But in the back of my mind, I kind of knew I didn't want to admit it, that I had a problem with alcohol. And that I was an alcoholic. So, I continued. You hear a lot, I was a functioning alcoholic. And I had a job. I was making good money at the time. Two cars, house, wife, two small kids. But my drinking was escalating. I was drinking more. I was drinking more frequently. I ended up drinking so much that I got pancreatitis. Went to the hospital, spent about close to a week in the hospital. And you'd think that would be enough. When I went into the hospital and they started asking me how much I drank. And I was perplexed. Like, why are you asking that? That has nothing to do with the fact that my stomach hurts.
And that's enormously painful, isn't it?
Yeah. That's not a good time. I started to think, maybe the drinking was part of it, but I was convinced it was something I ate. And so my primary care doctor came to visit and said, Tony, you don't have to quit drinking. Just have one or two a week. And before he visited, I was like, I think I might have to quit drinking altogether. But then he gave me the out. So I didn't have to quit.
Now that's interesting.
Yeah. In my mind, I was like, maybe it's, drinking related. I might have to quit. My wife was like, it's from drinking. You have to quit drinking. And then he came in and was like, keep it to one or two a week. And I was like, okay. Got out of the hospital following week, Friday rolled around and, he said I could have two. So I'm going to have two. Had two, and I was fine. You know, I didn't have any pain. And so, you know, I didn't enjoy having just two. Mm. Like, what's the point? You know, what's the point of having two beers? I don't want two beers. I want 10. I want 20. So it went from there. You know, I had my two a week, and within, you know, a few months, I was right back at it. 10 at a time, multiple times a week. You know, and my wife kept saying, you know, if you go back to the hospital, that's it.
So there's an ultimatum here.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I didn't quit. I didn't stop. I was starting to feel more pain in my stomach. I was feeling a little uncomfortable, you know, a little discomfort from...
But as long as you don't go to the hospital,
exactly,
it's okay.
Exactly, oh, right?
Dude.
So I have a little bit of discomfort. Yeah, I can handle that. Let me just take a day off, a couple days off, and then, yeah, all right, I'm feeling good. Yeah, let's have some. That's the insanity of it. Mm. That obsession of the mind. You know, I talked to my wife after I got sober. She's like, I think I understand the obsession. She said, I was coming home from work. I had a bag of chips and I couldn't stop eating the chips. I just kept eating them, these chips. And, you know, I ate the whole bag. And I said, well, no, you were hungry and you made a poor eating decision. I said, if you were obsessed, you would have opened the bag of chips and said, oh, this bag's kind of small. I wonder if I have any chips at home. What time is it? Can I get to the store to get enough, get more chips? Am I going to have any chips for tomorrow? Mm. That's the difference. The obsession is constant.
And nothing else matters but thoughts of chips, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was obsessed with alcohol. My life revolved around alcohol. Everything I did was so that I could drink the way that I wanted to. I was setting up everything in my life so that I could drink. And I didn't realize I was doing it. Everybody else could see that. Everywhere I went, you know, I was like, well, are they going to have a kid's party? Are they going to have beer? But, you know, I would bring my own, right? And so I would make sure that I had enough for the party, but then I also had enough for after the party because I didn't want to run out.
You know, right about here is in our last interview, we're approaching the point where you made me cry because it is evident in talking to 2019 Tony how much you love your family. And so hearing you talk about how you loved drinking more than them, it's painful to hear. And I know it is also painful for you to talk about. So thank you for sharing that. And with that, let's kind of pivot into that moment where you said, I'm done.
Okay. So I had continued, you know, out of the hospital. Wife was getting more and more upset with me. She was just tired of it. Since she felt like a single parent while I was there. She said it was almost worse that I was home and ignoring them than if I had just left altogether.
You were like another child, weren't you?
Yeah, but like a bad kid, like a bully who would make up excuses or reasons why I was upset so that they would leave me alone and so I could drink. I had a bad day at work. You have no idea how stressful it is. You have no idea what I'm going through. Leave me alone. I'll be in the garage.
And those are the garage sound effects, right?
Yeah, so my drinking escalated. She was getting more and more tired of this merry-go-round, this living this way. and it came to a head. It was either you have to leave or you have to get sober. And she was really of the opinion that it was over and that we were done. She had one foot out the door. And my last ditch effort was to go to a marriage counselor. So she agreed reluctantly. She didn't want to hear, "I'm sorry again, and this time it'll be different." But she agreed to go to the counselor. And in there, this guy, the first thing out of his mouth is about my drinking. I'm like, what is the problem? It's not, has nothing to do with my drinking. She's mad. Fix her. And that was it. He said, "Would you agree to go to an AA meeting?" And I was, yeah, okay, fine, I'll go. And that was January of 2010. January 30th of 2010 was the last time I had a drink. The last time I got drunk was that January New Year's Eve. Mm. And I remember I was drinking and my wife was there and my neighbor was over. And my brother had called at the time and he said he was going to try to quit drinking. And I told my wife that. She said, "Well, so are you." And I said, "Okay." I was like, "All right, I'll give it a shot." And so I drank as much as I possibly could that night because I knew I was going to try to not quit. So I better make this one count. And what I would normally do is, if I knew that I couldn't drink for like the next few days, is I would get really drunk so that I was so hungover that I didn't really want to drink. That I felt so sick that I wouldn't want to drink again for at least a couple of days. Mm. So that's what I did. I was able to go for the entire month. We went to the marriage counselor. It was in early February. And then I went to my first AA meeting. Mm. And I haven't had a drink since.
Wow. And that kind of takes me to one of my, actually, I guess this is the, was this the first drawing you did where there is a house ablaze and I guess the mom and the kids are running out of the house ablaze. There's a minivan and the bumper's all jacked up and then the cops are there. And the dude is laying out on the street, hanging on to a bottle of liquor. Is that one of your first ones? Is that where you were kind of getting sober and realizing that person that you were?
Yeah, that's the first illustration that I did in my sobriety for what has become 12 Steps Illustrated. That was the first illustration where I was talking to those guys about overcomplicating the steps and that people come in and they overcomplicate it and they don't quite understand it. And that's where I thought to myself, you know, the simplest form of communication is an image. So I tried to interpret step one into a single image. And that's what it came out to, was that chaos. And, you know, there's just everything's crazy. The house is on fire, crash the car, the cops are there, people are running away screaming, but he's laying there still holding his bottle, the bottle of booze. And that's what it came down to, is like everything, my life was completely unmanageable. Everything was falling apart. You know, my relationships, wasn't the best employee at work. Half the time I was hungover, sick, and it didn't matter. I still held on to that drink. So that's the first illustration that I did.
Do you remember showing that illustration to your wife, maybe as an acknowledgement that you had put them at risk and that you didn't either know or care?
Yeah, and I think, you know, when she saw it, she lived it. So some of these illustrations and some of the things that I share and or say are hard for her to hear. She lived it. And I have to remember that. And being in recovery too, it's I had to give her her space. I had to let her be pissed. You know, I couldn't convince people anymore. Don't be mad. Here's why you shouldn't be mad. You know, I was the ultimate salesman for myself. Well, I'm a great guy, and let me tell you why. I'm going to do A, B, C, D, which I never did. So, you know, she knew the real guy. And so one of the hard things about her being in recovery, too, is that I've built these expectations. People expect me to be drunk. That expectation is there. So now I'm saying, well, now I'm not going to do that anymore. You know, another one of the illustrations is a lady of a lady and says, you know, this is what it's like living with an alcoholic. And she's reared back, ready to looking to punch somebody in the face. And that's what it's like. You know, that's how I train these people to deal with me. If I go into a room and rear up like I'm going to punch somebody in the face, every time they see me, they're going to start putting their hands up, right? And I keep coming into the room, and every time I see this person, I'm like ready to punch them in the face. And so they're already defensive. But then all of a sudden, I come into the room, and I don't swing, or I don't rear up. And then I go, well, why are you protecting yourself? I've taught them that when they see me, you better protect yourself. And then I come in there and then I say, oh, I'm not going to do that anymore. So why are you trying to protect yourself? So that idea means that I have to see these people a lot and not swing at them in order for them to even put their guards down. And that takes time. They're only going to not react that way when they see me over time.
Yeah. How long did it take before you started to rebuild the trust in your family to realize you're a different guy?
It took, you know, some time, probably a couple of years. I know that's hard. That's hard in early sobriety to hear. But, you know, I remember 4 months, start to get some relief, you know, but at the same time, that thought is in the back of their minds. Like, well, is he really not going to drink again? Yeah, you have to remember, I'm the guy that drank so much that I went to the hospital.
Right.
And now, well, I haven't had a drink in 4 months. Don't be mad anymore for the last 25 years. You know, it doesn't work that way. You know, and over time, when I don't react the way that they're used to me acting, that's when they start to see that I'm not the same guy. A broken shoelace, I'll be in the garage drinking. And then the shoelace breaks again, and I don't do that. That's when people go, something's a little different here.
I want to look at another one of my favorite cartoons that you posted in December of last year. It's a couple of elves, and one guy's carrying the other one, and there's a, it looks like a pint of beer slipping or falling out of the, sloshing out of the mug. And it says, we can only carry the message, not the alcoholic. And I think it's interesting to pivot from that place where you have found empathy for your wife when you were newly sober. And now then you sponsor guys, and it's got to be really difficult now for you to mentor fellas and they relapse. Kind of what expectations, maybe advice or encouragement might you have for someone who's listening to this and they love someone who has a chemical addiction? And kind of pivot off of the this illustration about carrying the message, not the alcoholic.
Yeah, so working with other guys and trying to help other people is one of the best parts of being in recovery. It helps to keep me sober and step 12 is carrying the message to those alcoholics that are still suffering. And for me and a lot of guys that sponsor other people, you know, my sponsor too, you know, told me, you know, I can't get sober for you. I'm not going to work your program any harder than you are. Mm. And that's what it comes down to. I can't get anybody sober. I'm not God. And I don't have that power.
Step one.
Right. I can only share what I've done and what worked for me. And I think one of the valuable things about having so many people in recovery is that people relate to different people differently. You know, what I say may not appeal to somebody that says it a different way. You know, you can relate to different people more or less. And that's really what it came down to, is you find somebody that you can relate to, somebody that has what you want, somebody that acts the way that you want to be, and ask them for help. You know, I was talking to a guy this past week. He drank 2 days ago, called me up and said he needed help. And I said, well, I'm not sure how I can help you. You're already drunk. You know, I gave him a ride so he didn't get a DUI. And the illustration is, I have to be conscious that I'm not enabling somebody to continue.
Sure.
And in that illustration, how he's carrying the guy, and the elf that's carrying the guy is struggling.
Yeah.
Got the guy on his back in the bag, and the drunk guy in the bag is having a good old time.
Yeah.
He's smiling, he's happy, and he's spilling his drink, and he's just happy as can be, drunk. So that's really the illustration at the core. At its core is, I can't enable somebody else to continue. And I think that's really the hardest part, is when you love somebody who is in active addiction, you're almost helping them, you know. And I've heard it's possible to love somebody to death. I'm going to save them. I'm going to help them. I'm going to do this. And, well, if I don't do it, they won't eat. And if I don't do this, they won't do this. But at the end of the day, for me, my wife gave me all of my problems. This is yours. You've made this mess.
And I want to back into that just a little bit, because my wife gave me all of my problems. She didn't cause your problems. She just returned them to you.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
And again, there's another image there, or another conversation we had. And I was kind of coming to the realization that I was an adult. And then, you know, I had caused some damage, and, you know, it was like, shit's getting real. And she's like, you know, shit's been real. You were drunk. And that was the reality. It's like, there's all of these responsibilities that I just didn't partake in. She was unwillingly or unknowingly helping me to stay drunk.
So you think her ultimatum maybe saved your life? We know it saved your marriage.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, that's one of the hardest things, you know, is like, nobody comes into AA on a winning streak.
Never heard that one.
Each of us has our own bottom. You know, my bottom was, I didn't want to lose my marriage, and I didn't want another man to raise my kids. That was enough for me. It's not for everybody. Depending who you talk to, they might say I'm a high bottom, but each person has their own bottom.
So tell me, what's your life like now? I mean, I know that you're involved in your kids' lives. I know you have one child who is on a swim team. Is that right? And you're really good about not missing that. And I just think that's awesome. So paint a picture of what your life is like right now.
Life is good for me right now. You know, I can't say that it's perfect, but I'm available. I'm participating in my own life. I have two kids and a dog and a wife, and we struggle together. We've you know, had good times and bad times. We've lost friends in the program. People have gotten sick. We've had family members pass away, lost jobs, got jobs, moved cross country, moved back. And through all of that, I was sober. Mm. There's no situation now in my life that I can't make worse. Mm. You know, in every situation, no matter what it is, if I'm drunk, it'd be 10 times worse. And the problem is still going to be there. Just somebody else is going to have to do it because I'm over here drunk.
Wow. That's deep, Tony.
Like a puddle.
It is like, no, it's deeper than that. I've got one more question about one more cartoon because I'm curious about this. The St. Patrick's Day, as we're recording this, it's the 16th, so it's St. Patty's Day weekend. And this illustration is a St. Patty's Day dude, and he says, "You'd best be wrecking me good name and desecrating me holiday." It's almost like,
yeah,
St. Patrick is like, this isn't me, right?
So, yeah, what he's saying is, "You best be done wrecking me holiday and desecrating me good name." Basically, every holiday when I was drinking was a reason or an excuse to overindulge, right? Now I'm going to drink the way I want to because it's St. Patrick's Day and I can't. You're supposed to. You know, my wife is actually Irish, and I remember at one point she's like, you know, it's kind of upsetting that St. Patrick's Day is a drinking holiday and everybody associates it with being Irish. And this was kind of a little bit of a, you know, a thank you to her in a way. It's not about getting, St. Patrick's Day isn't about getting drunk anymore. But it didn't matter what holiday it was. You know, it could be Wednesday as an excuse.
It's a bit of a social commentary, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's, for me, St. Patrick's Day was always a big drunk holiday. But so was Cinco de Mayo, 4th of July, Groundhog's Day, you know, you name it.
Wow. Tony, I love your work. And I hope people will come to your website, 12stepsillustrated.com, and subscribe and get your monthly stuff because it is so good. And what we've already talked about, there are days when instead of laughing, I cry. Because in that first illustration that you walked me through with your wife and your kids coming flying out of the house and the nuclear bomb and stuff, for me that wasn't funny. It was fascinating. It was like staring at a train wreck, you know, and I recognize, you know, there's pain there. So there's a lot of emotion in your work. And I have no doubt that you are helping people recover by simplifying the steps, which is kind of all you set out to do. So tell me, what's coming for you? Are you going to do a 2020 calendar, or are you going to do a book? What are you wanting to do, my brother?
Well, yeah, actually, I'm thinking about doing a book, more like a daily reflections in comic form, and planning on doing the 2020, and I'm going to continue with the monthly subscription. The monthly comic is now in, I think, 4 or 5 states, shipping out every month. And yeah, I'm hoping that people like it. And I'm trying to keep it free to people in recovery. And the way I'm doing being able to do that now is through some advertising. So people that are in recovery, looking to reach people in recovery, can advertise on the back. And that helps me to keep it free to people that are in the program, because like I said earlier, you know, a lot of us aren't coming in on winning streaks, so we can't really afford a whole lot of extra things. But the hope is that it does help somebody. You know, it's gateway literature to the big book.
Oh, that is brilliant. I'd never looked at it that way. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot, you know, and for me personally, I've always struggled with reading. It's not my favorite thing to do. And I think I'm not alone in that regard. I think there's quite a few people that struggle with reading, but they understand images and concepts. And that's kind of my hope, is that it will help somebody to understand something through the images and lead them to pursue the program through the images.
How does someone get in touch with you besides 12stepsillustrated.com? You've got a Facebook page. Can someone send you an email? Or
yeah, folks can email me at contact@12stepsillustrated.com. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Pinterest. The easiest way to get a hold of me is through email or Facebook messages or Instagram messages.
Well, I wish you well, and I want us to definitely stay in touch, because I want to be part of the process of helping you distribute your work and carry the message of recovery. Is there anything that you want to say to encourage someone before we let you get on with the rest of your Saturday?
Yeah, I just want to say thanks for having me on again. I appreciate your time, and I'm always happy to talk about recovery, you know, and if somebody's out there struggling with recovery and they don't know what to do or where to go, there's AA meetings in nearly every city in every country around the world. If you're struggling, go there, tell somebody you need help, and there's somebody there that will help you. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. So let's be honest. It's never a good thing for a podcaster to have audio problems that force me to have to ask a guest to repeat an interview. That's never a good thing. But in this case, I'm okay that we had a problem, because I feel like I know Tony better after a pair of hour-long conversations. We're working on some stuff together, and Tony is as authentic as they come. Man, I'm so glad I can share this story with you, and I pray that you have picked up a useful nugget or two. I think his mantra, "It's hard to be miserable when you're laughing," is pretty spectacular. I can remember that that I knew I was getting better when I realized I was laughing again. The show notes for this episode are at rebootspodcast.com/episode47. Now, that's where we're going to have links to Tony's social media accounts and to the book he recommends. And be sure, no kidding, be sure you sign up for his email list so you don't miss a single one of his works. So, one more thing. If you like what you're hearing on Reboots, head on over to iTunes. Post an honest review, would you? We really appreciate the feedback. It helps us make decisions about the kinds of topics and stories you want to hear. And, oh yes, it does help others find us a lot easier. It's pretty easy for you to access Reboots in the iTunes store. Go to rebootspodcast.com/iTunes. I'm Tracy Winchell. We'll see you next time. Deo Valente.
We hope this episode has helped you in some way. If so, we'd love to hear from you. Maybe someone you care about might benefit from the Reboots podcast. It's easy to share from our website, rebootspodcast.com. Rebootspodcast.com. The Reboots podcast is a production of Winchell Storyworks Incorporated, a company dedicated to helping businesses and individuals know, share, and live their stories in order to impact the world around us in a positive way and to achieve financial freedom.